Welcome. Welcome to Midtown Brewing Company and Michigan Radio's Issues in Ale. My name is Steve Kropinski. I'm the marketing director at Michigan Radio. Question, how many of you here, this is your first time at an Issues in Ale event? All right, well, a lot of newbies here. That's great. Well, thank you all for coming. So we're going to have a great night. We already have a great crowd here. We're going to be talking politics, as Rick says, politics and beer. What could go wrong with that? Before we get started, I have a couple quick announcements to make. First off, I do want to thank Mark and the great staff here at Midtown Brewing Company for hosting us tonight. Have a big round of applause for them. We could not do it without them giving us this great venue for this discussion here right in downtown Lansing, so we thank them very much. I also want to acknowledge a couple of our staff that are here as well. Bob Scott, who's our chief engineer, doing the audio. Alyssa Daniels, who is with our corporate support department. Alyssa is here live tweeting, so if you're on Twitter tonight, we use the hashtag, hashtag issues and ale. So feel free to join in with your comments on Twitter as well tonight. And I know we got a big crowd here. If anybody wants to pull up a chair, you can grab a seat in this area. I know we're probably short of seats, or you can stand up wherever. I know those of you who are behind the posts, if you can't see us, you'll hopefully at least be able to hear what's going on tonight. I do want to let you know a couple other things. If you did not come in through this entrance here, we have a ticket giveaway we're doing tonight. We're giving away a pair of tickets to see the Moth main stage in East Lansing coming up later this month at the Wharton Center. So just fill out an entry form for that, and you could win a pair of tickets to see the Moth. A great night of storytelling coming right here to East Lansing in just a couple of weeks. We also have some other great giveaways. We've got our I Listen, I Vote Michigan Radio pins, buttons, and I Heart NPR buttons, and we've got some other great tchotchke over there, so you can feel free to pick those up as well. And I think that is it. Without further ado, I'm going to turn you over to our host tonight. First off, Zoe Clark.
Hi, everyone. Hello. I am Zoe Clark. This is Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. If you live in Lansing, if you have ever been to Lansing, you most likely have seen Rick Pluta here in Lansing before. Or at least heard him, exactly.
And not on the radio, just if you're hanging out downtown.
And he's Caleb Pluta's father as well.
That's true. Actually, and first of all, welcome to your capital city and my hometown. So glad to have you here. Also, a big shout out to a table back there. From our West Side Neighborhood Association, who staged their own voting march that they walked in, they voted at the Letts Community Center, and then marched down here for Issues in Ale. So way to go, guys. It's my job to introduce our special guests, experts, starting with the person to my immediate left. Long before Sarah Palin was going rogue, Joe DeSano was providing counsel and advice to Democratic candidates. And this is Joe DeSano right near, who is a partner in Main Street Strategies and a general, all about sort of Democratic Party troublemaker.
Troublemaker, I think going rogue may be accurate. I just like to think I do it, unlike Sarah Palin, I try to do it with three-digit IQ.
To my far left is the former and very longtime serving chairman of the Michigan Republican Party and a person who's been working for quite some time trying to get the GOP into using modern voter ID and communications technology. Now he is an independent political consultant, Saul Anuzis. Please welcome him.
Great to be here.
So where should we begin?
I think we should start in a little city, you might have heard of it, called Detroit. City that's having some issues, financially speaking. And just today, this afternoon, in fact, House Speaker Jace Bulger announced a special committee in the House, two Republicans on the committee, two Democrats, and a Republican chair. So 3-2, a little not quite how the House is set up. but we've got a majority of Republicans on this special committee to
by
look
one.
At. By one.
By one. The majority is made up. It's two Democrats, two Republicans, and a Republican chair, John Walsh, who's kind of, he's in the leadership. He's the president pro tem of the House, and he's considered kind of part of their problem-solving team. The Democrats that they put on the board are not exactly, I don't think that they would be considered top team players in the Democratic coalition.
And again, what we should
Let me ask my buddy, Jake Neer, is that an accurate characterization?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what this is just a committee to simply even look at possible legislation that no one in this room, I'm assuming, has seen yet about a possible bailout, don't call it a bailout, settlement for the city of Detroit. Saul Anuzis, as a Republican, where are you seeing the most opposition to some type of state money to Detroit? I don't think it's fair to say it's purely Republican opposition.
But let's start with the Republican opposition.
Well, look, I mean, first of all, it's kind of a responsible opposition. I mean, if there's any opposition, first of all, everybody wants to see what kind of real reforms are there, what kind of checks and balances are there going to be, and what we don't want to do is finance another problem all over again. So if the reforms and the commitments that the city of Detroit is willing to make and can make don't make sense, I think there's going to be a lot of opposition. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of openness to trying to figure out a way to help. I mean, Detroit is still the largest city. Every Republican since I've been involved in politics has been committed to trying to help the city of Detroit turn itself around. you know, I ran for a city charter commission when I was living in the city of Detroit, and many of us, you know, came up from there. So we realized the greatness that Detroit could have. And I think there's a lot of frustration right now as people are trying to figure out what we can do next to actually make something happen there.
Is it politically viable? Can an outstate Republican, especially one, say, north of Clare, if not north of DeWitt, actually
north
vote,
of 8 Mile,
vote for financial assistance for the city of Detroit?
It very much would depend on the entire package. The answer is yes, but it's not just going to be a bailout. It's not going to be free money to city of Detroit.
There's talk right now about two different sort of pools of money. One is this idea that we would see something like $17, $18 million over a 20-year period. This would come from money that all states get.
$250 million.
No, $20 million
oh,
over
a year. Okay.
Right, over right, like right. 20 years, $17, $18 million. So that's one idea. That would be $350 million over about 20 years. Now it's looking like, even after Kevin Orr saying possibly he would be more behind a lump sum payment of something like $195 million, that's even in the plan of adjustment that came out today. Is one more politically palatable to Republicans?
Is one lump sum payment, even if it's a little bit less than $350 million, okay, $100 million less, more viable than stretching it out
Look,
over 20 years?
That's a question to be pretty tough for me to answer. I mean, I think there's just a lot of variations, a lot of details going on internally. They're trying to figure out where they can get the votes. I mean, I suspect that the leadership that is interested in being helpful is actually looking at what do we need to do to put together enough votes to make this a viable political
option. Joe DeSano.
The part that no one knows here is what goodies are being dangled among in front of legislators in an election year to, frankly, get their vote.
So explain what those might include possibly.
Appropriations of some type. Promises of committee positions next term.
Another beer would be helpful.
Another couple of beers.
Hefeweizen.
I mean,
there's
going to be a significant amount of horse trading going on because you're asking outstate Republicans to do something that they are intrinsically opposed to. And you know, I'll differ with my friend Saul here about this. He says that you know he's been trying to help Detroit for years. Republicans have been using Detroit as a political pinata for 40 years.
So have Macomb County Democrats.
Oh, absolutely. I've written some of that literature for sure.
So let me ask you about this and Democratic support for the Detroit bailout, which is how tough is it for Democrats, especially Democrats that are representing districts that have either cities or school districts that have been taken over? And have those community leaders going, well, where's our bailout?
That's a really good question. In fact,
it's a great question.
I'll be honest. I have a client that's running for the state senate. I told him not to vote for this. It's not in his best interest.
So this is something that I'm hearing a lot about, that these sort of individual lawmakers are going, I don't want to vote for it, but it needs to happen. How do you reconcile that? How do you make something happen when these individual votes aren't there, but overall for the greater good, you're hearing Governor Snyder, Kevin Orr push for it?
You got to go find a stooge to take the fall for you.
Well, look, I think you need members who are in safe districts who can actually be statesmen and run this thing. I mean, the hard part is, again, coming up with a package that actually makes sense that Republicans are willing to vote for and Democrats are willing to vote for. And that's not an easy thing to do. And I think the one thing that leadership has learned the hard way, hopefully they've learned the hard way, is you just can't expect and have people just fall in line and vote for some package that they think doesn't make political sense, let alone economic sense.
So
okay,
right
well,
now,
give us your prediction. How does this play out? Because remember, also, if it's going to happen while before the bankruptcy is wrapped up, it's got to happen in the next month and a half.
I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure to do something. I don't know what that something is, and I think that there is a realization we have to do something. But the problem is it's not going to be a giveaway, and that's going to be a tough political battle for people to come up with the final answer.
The goodies have to be distributed, but also there has to be political pressure from some really heavy hitters in the Republican Party. It also has to happen on issues like roads. So a lot of tender spots are going to get squeezed here in the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, and we saw Kevin Orr last week, I think it's fair to say, lobbying for that money. Is that a good sign to see him there? Would it be better if he stayed in? I mean, is it good for him to be the face of this?
I think it's a fine idea for him to come here and ask for it. I think doing it by remote control and by proxy, I think, doesn't develop the relationships and the trust you need in order for this to happen.
He has no choice. He has to be here.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and one of the interesting things that when Kevin Orr was here, that he was someone who, you know, he's a high-powered attorney. He very much behaved as someone who knew his place, that he was here to explain the bankruptcy, that he was not going to delve into legislative tactics and how the legislature maybe ought to go about it. He said, that's not me. That's not my role. He was here to sell not even the bailout part of it, but just to explain the bankruptcy part of it, although I suspect he will have to come back to sell the bailout part of it.
Okay. Well, enough of us for this quick second. Let's open it up to questions. We kind of like to do it in topics. So right now, let's try to keep them to Detroit.
Any questions on the Detroit bailout?
And Steve Krupinski right here has a roving microphone. So if you've got questions, he is the person whose eye
he's our
catch.
Oprah.
Seriously, no Detroit questions.
Oh, but I'd still love that beer.
It's on. Here it is. Big round of applause.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Well,
let's move on.
Should we do a quiz question?
Sure.
Okay. The other thing we like to do is quiz questions. So Steve Krupinski is not only has the microphone, he is playing Vanna White. So as you can see, the Issues and Ale Michigan Radio pint glass can be yours.
Pint glass?
Oh, it is not a pint glass. I totally just lied. It's only 12 ounces. It's not 16
ounces. It's 12 ounces, but it will hold a standard bottle of beer, cider, soda, if you're inclined that way.
Okay.
So, which one are we doing? All right.
Raise your hand.
Oh, right. And
okay, and you have to raise your hand. Do you know who is credited? Who knows who is credited with coining the term Michigander? Give us your name.
Enrique Bustillos.
And?
I believe it is Abraham Lincoln.
You are correct.
All right, there you go.
Abraham Lincoln served one term in Congress, but during that term, he delivered a speech where he was poking fun at Lewis Cass, who was considered to be a rather vain character. He was over in the Senate, and so he referred to him as a Michigander. And he's basically calling him a silly goose. So, by the way, can anyone say more volume? The answer is Abraham Lincoln. He went on to save the Union.
I think he was a Republican, if I'm not mistaken.
And as a follow-up, this is not for a prize, but just let's see who knows this. Our current governor, one Rick Snyder, has weighed in on whether we, who are from Michigan, are Michiganians or Michiganders. Do we know which side? And Geraldine Lasher takes it.
Michigander. We're silly geese.
It's true. It's
okay.
True.
Okay. So
next topic.
Let's move on quickly because let's talk quickly about transportation funding, road funding, something that everyone seems to have come into contact with over the past couple months after a really horrendous winter. How many people here would like to see an increase in road funding? How many people here would like to pay for it?
Okay. How many people here would suffer a tax increase? Okay. I like where is Steve?
Unhappily. Okay, so $100 a year.
Okay. Well, $100 a year, that would barely be the tax reduction.
No, I mean, I'm just interested to see where the number is. I mean, $500 a year for roads per person.
So, were you working in the Senate the last time we did a tax increase, a gas tax increase?
I think. When was it?
It was during the Engler administration, and you were, Saul, okay. For some reason, we've asked as our guest experts people who basically cannot hold a job.
At least the same job, right?
The same job. They've done many things, and one of the things that Saul did was that he was the chief of staff to State Senate Majority Leader Dick Postumus. So, and I believe that was about the time that we did our last real fuel tax increase under the Engler administration. What needs to come together for something like that to happen?
Well, look, I think there's a realization that we obviously have a problem with the roads and the bridges, et cetera. And I think we're looking at, you know, a use tax is still more saleable to a Republican than something else because at least we know where it's going, or at least we think we know where it's going. You know, part of the problem is just like the lottery, we tend to divert money somewhere else once we fund what initially was supposed to be an added revenue source. So, you know, that's going to be an issue. But I think all of us who've come off a tough winter, I mean, my wife just rotated front tires to the back because the rims were, you know, got bent because we hit too many potholes going through just driving back and forth. So I think there is a desire to find the appropriate amount of road funding. One of the challenges we've had for the last 30 years is, you know, do we make a long-term investment with respects to building roads that will actually last a little longer, or do you put another 2 inches on top and pass it down to the next, you know, political battle? And that's a big one because it's extremely expensive when you start looking at that.
Well, this one is for both of you. That one of the things that really seems to get to people is when they find out that a big part of the money that they're paying at the pump is for the sales tax. And, of course, a big portion, not the gasoline tax, not the fuel tax, but the 6% sales tax. And a big portion of the sales tax does not go to roads. Is doing something like that going to be a necessary element of pulling together an arrangement?
I think you have to be very wary of the bait and switch when it comes to paying for things. I think Saul's absolutely correct. People have to feel that the money they're putting forward is going forth to the solution. And I think you've reached a point now where the public is ready. It's just a question of what the contours of the deal are going to be. And like you alluded to, is it the big fix or is it the 2 inches? I mean, I would hope if we're going to go down this road, I really think it needs to be the big fix. What I don't want to see happen is duping a bunch of Democrats to vote for a tax increase and end up like, you know, Lucy in the football in the Peanuts cartoons. So that would be my advice to my Democratic friends. Don't be dupes. Everyone's got to be in this together.
And make sure that some of that road money is going to your district?
That would be smart politics.
I mean, that's part of the controversy right now, which is the distribution formula.
The distribution right now is keenly to the benefit of Republicans. So that has to change if you want any significant Democratic buy-in to this.
So when you look at all of those moving parts, Democrats needing to squeeze Republicans for enough of a benefit to make it happen. Republicans needing to win enough of a benefit so that they can go back to their primary voters. Because remember that, you know, that most of the people who are voting for this have to go back and convince Republican voters in a Republican primary to do this. Is this doable?
It's very tough. Look, I think the one dynamic that has changed in the last 20 years is that now most politicians are worried about primary challenges versus general election challenges. And so, you know, if you're a Republican, you're worried about getting challenged from the right in most cases. You know, Democrats have their challenges, whether it's labor, geographic, or something else. But we're now looking at, because of gerrymandering and the way the districts have been made up, is most races are in the primary. And so it pushes both sides to extremes. It changes the dynamics of any discussion because they are, again, looking at it from a primary standpoint. So I think it's going to be very difficult. I mean, is there a solution? Probably. There has to be. But I don't know. I'm not sure where it's at, and I'm not sure what the easy one is. And, you know, this is one that it has to be a bipartisan solution. Some of these tougher votes virtually have to be bipartisan. Otherwise, they're not going to happen.
Any questions? Go ahead.
Sorry.
Put down the beer, Steve.
Have another beer.
Hi, what's your name?
I'm Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Zoe. Some of us, whether we're Democrat, Republican, right or left, have memories of privatization, of selling all of the road equipment very cheaply to people who took it. And
you're talking about the 496 project, right?
A lot of projects. If we're going to invest again to actually have roads that work, is there a quality control component that makes us feel we're investing something that's going to last, or is it going to privatization that's going to be quick, seal it over, and it's done, and there's nothing to happen from it?
Here is the balancing act, that anything they do has to be a real fix. I think there's probably a general recognition that, you know, that throwing asphalt into holes is not going to be sufficient. But
it may be a union job, but it's not sufficient.
Well, with union jobs, you get top-notch quality and a good wage for the workers. So yeah, absolutely.
I think we should raise the minimum wage to $26 an hour here too. Let's see how many people ask.
We're getting some claps for $26.
I won't argue with that.
Everyone at the public radio table is clapping. every level of solution requires a bigger level of investment. Every bigger level of investment requires squeezing the driving taxpayers for more. And so the question is, how do you find that sweet spot that gets you to a point where you've convinced the public that you've acceptably solved the problem without squeezing them so much that they feel like you're wasting their money?
And there's another element to this, because it's not just the driving taxpayers of the state of Michigan who are causing a lot of these problems. A lot of it is caused by these huge axle trucks coming in and tearing the roads up year after year.
Which is part of this $500 million plan that Jace Bulger has started to put together, that we would see some weight limit increases.
I think that's certainly a good first step to this. And I'll give the speaker credit, and I give him credit for little. He's right on this.
So like Jay Carney, we will allow one follow-up. Just yell it out. We'll repeat it back. Okay.
My question is, is there a quality control component?
That's my point. There has to be.
Exactly.
There has to be.
We gave the contract out. Is there a follow-up?
There will have to be. I have not seen a package, Jake, that has not had that as some sort of an element. Yeah, it's more and longer warranties is what Jake Neer just said.
But,
well,
you know,
put.
One of the things, if you take a look at, for instance, what Indiana has done. I mean, Indiana has privatized certain roads. They've actually signed 30-year contracts. And now these guys who are coming in are basically building roads to last 30 years. Because now it's a private business that's making a business decision to do that. So, you know, if you take a look at like 94 or 96, especially with the trucks going through, and you look at the you look at the weight that's coming on there, I'd rather have these guys. I mean, 94 in particular, if you take a look at what it does, is it serves as one of the major thoroughways for trucks coming from Mexico to Canada, et cetera, and coming through 96. Why not have all these people who are shipping goods to Canada and Mexico back and forth pay their fair share? So, you know, I think taking a look at privatization in very specific areas might make some sense in the long term. And there's other states that have effectively done it, and there's countries around the world that have done it very effectively.
And then one of the elements of that plan is the idea has been thrown out that you make the building company, the company that builds the road, is also the maintenance company.
Absolutely.
So they have the responsibility to construct a road that is easy to maintain. It becomes their problem.
So that's it's just policy. Let's move on to it's just politics. You brought up the minimum wage, Saul. Let's talk a little bit. Right now, there is a voter-initiated law out in the field looking to gather hundreds of thousands of signatures to increase Michigan's minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Suddenly, we see some legislation from Republicans saying, well, how about 8-ish, a little more. Joe DeSano, will that pass? Was that smart politics to come in and sort of, Rick and I argue about whether to use the word co-opt or not, but to take over that
I
issue
say
as
preempt.
Their own?
Preempt or co-opt, we still have to remember it's coming from a legislative buffoon like Rick Jones. Buffoon. Argue with me. Go ahead. Now, they very well may preempt this and try to get a hold of, beat Democrats on the issue.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me for just a moment.
Yes.
One vote for preempt.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay, Saul.
Look, you know, we have to, there's no doubt everybody would like to have everybody pay more money for whatever they're doing. I mean, it'd be nice to have a minimum wage that made sense. The problem is what we're trying to address are the people who are most hurt by this minimum wage. I mean, if you take a look at the folks in Detroit as an example, I mean, we have very high unemployment amongst young African-American kids who are basically looking at some very basic talents that they have to have. And to say that you're forcing people, you know, like Seattle now is looking at raising it, you know, what is it, $17 or something? Somebody else is talking about $25. What is it, $15? I mean, there are people, you have to be realistic that there are certain people who can't perform duties that make that work.
But you're looking at a situation where you are using a little bit of a straw man, because the average minimum wage worker isn't a 17-year-old African-American kid. It's a 35-year-old single mom. It's a 45-year-old second income in a house. And, you know, if I don't like people who don't work for a living, okay? I want to help the people who are out there busting their humps to make a living. And that's why we need to look at raising the minimum wage. We need to get out in front of reinstating the earned income tax credit here in the state. There are things that we can do to reward work.
Let's ask this. This is a politics. Okay. Is minimum wage, $10.10 minimum wage, if it gets on the ballot, is it an effective tool to bring out Democratic voters?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I think we should start giving away cars and houses as well, and I think that'd be very effective.
So
who does not want a free house? I'll take a free house.
Okay. And we should.
There you go. From the mouth of babes.
And my son has accepted your offer, Saul. We've had offer.
Look, This is a hard argument, because anytime you have an entitlement of any kind, it's very difficult to pull back.
And this isn't an entitlement. This is people getting up in the morning, having a cup of coffee, and busting their hump to make a living.
But let's get back.
How much are you willing to pay for a Big Mac and a cup of coffee?
Well, first of all, I haven't had a Big Mac in over a year. I would pay.
I was going to crack a joke, but I'm not going to.
I would pay a good $5.
Well, there you go.
You know what? I'll pay a little bit more at McDonald's if it means that that person can go home and stretch their income just a little bit more. I'm willing to do it. It's, you know, maybe it's a difference of philosophy. Maybe we're different people. That's just the way it's going to be, I guess.
But I want to get back to this because we were talking about it as a turnout tool. That right now, we're all agreed that the 2014 election is going to be decided on whether or not Democrats can turn out their voters. Republicans turn out midterms, especially when there's a Democratic president in the White House. But it's going to be decided. Are we agreed on that? Yes, no?
I agree with the premise.
Saul?
Yeah, I mean, in general, sure.
Okay. So why is the minimum wage such an effective tool versus all the other things that could be out there?
Well, for one, how often can you go into the ballot box and give yourself a raise? That doesn't happen too often.
And yet what we're seeing when we're seeing polls, it's not just Democrats who are for a minimum wage.
No,
when
it's
you
across
actually
the
look
board.
At it, it's about 56% Republicans and closer to 79% for Democrats.
And I'll tell you why. Because for 30 years in this country, we've had stagnant wage growth. Actually, more than 30 years, we've had stagnant wage growth. We've offset it by, you know, importing huge amounts of goods from Asia. I mean, hey, if you need a $10 DVD player, this is the place to be, okay? But the point is, people's wages have not grown, with the exception of a blip during the Clinton years, later in the Clinton years. So everyone's struggling to make a living, Democrats and Republicans.
So, Saul, what do Republicans do to offset whatever advantage that might be created by a minimum wage ballot question? And I'm not suggesting that it is automatically enough of advantage to change the course of candidate elections.
Well, look, I do think it's an advantage for Democrats to put the minimum wage on or issues like that. I mean, that and Republicans have done the same thing, whether it was, you know, traditional marriage back when, et cetera. So there are issues that get put on the ballot to try to draw all your base out. The issue is, you know, look, Republicans have a problem in the sense that we, I think, have a lousy brand. We've done a lousy job of messaging of who we are and what we stand for. You know, we used to, you know, if you take a look at, you know, I grew up in the city of Detroit. You know, my father was what they referred to as a Reagan Democrat. You know, spent 32 years in UAW on the line. I mean, he always thought he was a Democrat. And so I think that, you know, but we appeal to the working class people because we talked about opportunity. We talked about, you know, where people had to go. And today we don't do that. We spend more time fighting amongst each other, trying to push each other, you know, to one side or another on a specific issue. And I think that creates a problem. So, you know, until we get candidates and people talking about solving problems, being real. I mean, look, one of Rick Snyder's biggest assets is the fact that he is the most non-political politician we've seen probably since a Bill Milliken. He is, you know, many Republicans will complain about his lack of partisanship on our side. We'd like to see him be more out there raising money, pushing political issues, et cetera, where he's looking for a way to get things done.
And I'm going
to, it's frustrating.
We're going to open this up entirely to election 2014 politics in just a few minutes, where we will talk about the gubernatorial race. We do have a question here in the back that I want to get to because you've been waiting so patiently.
I know.
Thank
Who
you.
Are you?
Very patiently. My name is Sue Ault, and I just want to say the problem with politicians is they don't know when to stop talking. But my comment was I wanted to be clear. Did I hear you refer to the minimum wage as an entitlement? An entitlement? The minimum wage? Sir, for people that are out there working every day, working 35 to 40 hours a week, this is not an entitlement. This is trying to live. This is trying to make our mortgage payments. Could you please... explain that to me.
My comment was, I said, with respects to the minimum wage being a good political issue, bringing it up, just like any other entitlement, I didn't mean to say that was an entitlement. Look, here's the problem with the minimum wage. From my perspective, why not go to $25 an hour? I mean, if we're really going to set a minimum wage...
That's ridiculous. Don't really. Do that.
Why?
That's preposterous. Why don't we just take it to $1,000?
There you go.
Hour?
I'm all in.
Or that's let's ridiculous. Just repeal it entirely.
If you're making a, if
you're, let's if get you're rid of child
okay.
labor laws.
Okay.
We have another question. We have a few more questions out there. So yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sue. We've got another. We will let Steve.
Hi, I'm Steve. I have a comment. Minimum wage to me should be high enough that the people don't have to turn to other public services. We are spending a tremendous amount of money on public services.
Agreed.
We have a sign over here talking about kids in the state who are hungry. Their parents are working. They deserve to earn a living.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. If we're going to do a minimum wage, let's do one where people can make a living.
Yeah, that's right. And let's get rid of the Walmart subsidy. How many Walmart employees are on the public dole?
The Walmart employees, how many, you know, look at the waiters in here. Look at the people who are working for, I mean.
Let's let this gentleman have his.
So, my name is Tom. Two things. One, to
Hi,
your
Tom.
Point about the servers here, they're not 17 years old working minimum wage. They're much older than 17. Okay.
All right.
I want to just throw in
However,
one quick note. So this is, it's just politics on NPR. On NPR, we're very nice, maybe to a fault. We don't like to raise our voices. I know we are passionate people, all of us here together, but let's just, like, have a sip of whatever we're drinking. I was born and raised in Ann Arbor, so let's all just take a little breath. I don't think a sip is what they did.
All things considered, you may have a point.
Exactly. So let's all bring it down a little bit. We can all talk nicely to one another. We all have different viewpoints. Okay.
My question is, during the conversation, you nodded your head and said in agreement that everyone is struggling to make ends meet right now. If it isn't a minimum wage increase, what is it that's going to help these families?
I think that's a great question. Look,
it's a great question.
I think that is a challenge. I would argue that we need to basically go back to a system where we're actually creating jobs in this country that people can actually make a good living at. So if you're sitting there, look, you know, Keystone Pipeline, lots of good jobs there, so we could be energy independent instead of having our sons and daughters dying overseas for a barrel of oil. I mean,
well, I'm glad you guys are finally admitting that's what it was.
Sorry, I didn't hear that. I was speaking. I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. I said I was glad that you guys are finally admitting that's what that was about.
Well, I've always admitted. Look, I have four sons. You know, the last thing I want to do is see one of my boys go over and die for a barrel of oil, which I think is absolutely stupid, when we can, you know, we can drill here, drill now, to use a slogan, and basically be energy self-sufficient for hundreds, if not thousands of years between what we have in North America. So I think, again, there's a lot of policies that we could change that would make this a more attractive place to do business, have good jobs, good paying jobs, that would make this a great country. And right now what we're doing, and look, what's the actual solution? If I knew the actual solution, I'd be president. I don't know what the actual solution is.
I got one.
Okay.
Repeal child labor laws, and we can bring back all the iPad production into the United States. Because we don't need a minimum wage. Let's get rid of child labor laws, too. My 10-year-old here, his hands are small. He's dexterous.
Let's put him to work.
We have another comment or question in the back.
Hi, my name is Nick. Saul, unfortunately, this is also going to be directed towards you. I think you've upset a few
people. Someone had to be
here.
The token Republican in the group, all right? That's all right.
You speak in one breath about the youth in Detroit, and then without really changing any sort of pace, you then go on to say some people aren't worth a minimum wage increase. How is it that we can increase CEO pays exponentially higher than a floor person or a line person who's just had stagnant growth, and then you turn around and you don't want to pay people more?
Well, look, I am not going to defend 99% of the CEO's pay. I think these guys are overpaid. I think they're stealing money from the American people, and I think that shareholders ought to kick their butts out of office, so to speak, out of their positions. I think it's outrageous, the money that a lot of these people are making, in a public company. If you're a private owner, that's a different story because it's your company, you're building, whether you like it or not. The reality is you're taking the risk, and you deserve it. But once you're a public company, I mean, the CEOs of General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, all the Fortune 500 companies that literally have thousands of shareholders that don't have a voice, I think it's highway robbery. I got no problem with, you know.
Is it fair to say, and this is for both of you, is it fair to say that both parties are too beholden to Wall Street?
Yes. Especially Obama, but absolutely yes.
I think Democrats have a problem.
Anybody look at the fund? All you guys are moaning. I mean, take a look at who funds the bailout. I mean, why did we bail out Wall Street? Why did Obama bail out Wall Street?
I'm gonna just institute the NPR
rule
again. I forgot
everything is George W. Bush's fault.
When the decimal gets too high, I just want to go drive a Volvo and drink a latte. So let's just bring it down a little bit.
And in fairness to that position, that there is a lot of Wall Street money that goes to Democrats and a lot of Democratic administrations that tap Wall Street, especially Goldman Sachs, where government service is considered part of the career ladder.
Okay, we've got another question.
Hi, my name's Melinda, and this is for the group in here. It's not for them. There was a vote here today in town for a millage extension. How many people besides me actually bothered to vote today?
West Side neighborhood over there. They definitely.
Okay. All right.
I didn't go with my West Side neighborhood group, but I did vote.
Yeah. Well, I think I would love another cider. Rick, would you like something else? Another libation? Okay. Sure. And on that note, let's turn to sex. or at least sexual identity, LGBT issues.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about how many people have actually heard of the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. And how many people believe that it makes sure that you can't get fired in the state of Michigan if you're gay?
Guess what? It doesn't.
So one of the issues...
This group would know that.
Right, right. So one of the issues that Rick and I have been covering quite a bit in our reporting is the idea of adding sexual identity, whether adding sexual identity toward the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. Joe DeSano, is that something that you think we'll see in this legislature?
I don't know if we'll see it in this legislature. We will see it in the next 24 months. It's a fait accompli. It's going to happen. Big business in this country has decided that demographically it's in their best interest for them to treat gay, lesbian, transgendered workers fairly. And frankly,
I would say at least gay and lesbian. I'm not sure that the business community is there on transgender.
The point being is the best demographic you want as a corporation are gays and lesbians. Many of them without children, lots of disposable income. Being anti-gay is bad business, and they finally figured it out.
Well, I have a question for Saul, and it is not a policy question. It is a political question. Is it a mistake for Rick Snyder not to try and get out more in front of this particular issue? As a tactical matter, not a
you know, I mean, I guess I don't know exactly what he has or hasn't done to get out in front of the issue. My argument is that there should be no discrimination of anybody of any kind, period.
Yep.
So, you know, to me, this isn't a partisan issue. Now, the fact that there are people who may be homophobic, the fact that there may be people who believe that for some reason or another it may or may not be good public policy, I mean, that's obviously the debate we're going to have. But, I think it's a very simple issue. I mean, I don't think anybody ought to be discriminated against,
you know,
including Democrats.
Saul should be getting some applause for this because he is in the minority in his party.
I'm not sure. Now, does everyone here know about the Southern strategy of the Republican Party back in the 1970s? That basically doomed the Republicans for...
Democrats.
Well, politically, but Republicans lost the African-American vote in a big way, and they did for a long time. Did the marriage amendments that we saw in the 1990s... do the same thing to Republicans with LGBT, do you think?
To some extent, but I mean, look, there are a lot of active gays that are Republican. There are, you know, people who share values that happen to be gay. And I think that, again, we have to figure out how to deal with that when you have a big part of our coalition is religious right. And so they have a very different part or a very different philosophical approach to where it's at. And, you know, I think the party would be better served if we had a little bit of tolerance with respect to people who disagree with us on specific issues. And, you know, I'm not one of those guys who, look, I am a very, very conservative person. You know, those of you who may have followed me over the years, I mean, in the old days, they used to write about me being a Neanderthal, you know. So it's not like I'm some kind of moderate, middle-of-the-road Republican. But having said that, I think that we need a bigger tent. I think we need to be tolerant. I think we have to understand that this is about, politically, this is about getting 50% plus one. So we have to build those coalitions. This is a center-right coalition that I believe is better served, or the country is better served, if we have one. And the only way to get a coalition is understand you're not going to agree with everybody 100% of the time on every issue.
Then what does that mean for the classic Reagan three-legged stool, that coalition of defense hawks, fiscal conservatives, and social conservatives?
Well, we have to bring in the Reagan Democrats, who were basically the culturally conservative people who had different views. I mean, look, my father was a great example of that. He was pro-life, but he couldn't tell you who Right to Life was. He believed everybody ought to have a gun and had a gun at home, but didn't know who the NRA was. He believed in traditional marriage, but didn't care what people did in their bedrooms. And I think that there are millions of people across America who share the same values. They are culturally conservative, who I think would very easily fit into our center-right coalition, agree to disagree on certain issues. But, you know, Reagan once said, if you're with me 70, 80% of the time, you're with me. Today we have people who say, if you're not with me 99.9% of the time, You're not with me. And that becomes a very difficult place in political realism and reality to actually put together coalitions and win elections. And I think we've got to, again, I'm not arguing for us to moderate in the sense of the issues we stand for. I'm suggesting that we have to be tolerant of the fact that not everyone's going to agree with us on all the different issues.
So, Saul, how do you fix that politically then? Because whether or not that's the case, I think there does seem to be this theme that Republicans, and maybe it's Democrats pushing it, whomever, that Republicans have this war on women. Young voters don't believe Republicans care that much about sexual identity. We're seeing issues of marijuana use and Republicans seeming like, not the Libertarian Party, but Republicans. How do you reach out to those voters and make them believe what you're saying right now? How do you change that message?
Look, this is all going to be about candidates running. I don't think that a party as an organization can basically go out and sell themselves to the American public and say, this is where we stand and who we are. The candidates and the parties are judged on their candidates. And so as we run people who are going to represent us, I think that that's what people are going to look at in the Republican Party. I mean, Rick Snyder is a certain kind of Republican.
Yes, he is.
And if you go around, there's a lot of people all over the state will look at him and say, I like that. Then you can take a look at the national level. We're going to have anybody from a Rick Santorum on one side to a Ted Cruz somewhere over here. And you're going to have, you know, Rand Paul at another end. You've got a very diverse situation. You know, right now there's like 26 potential candidates on the Republican side. And truly, we're fighting for the heart and soul of what the Republican Party is all about.
But almost to a person, they're all pro-life, all want to legislate the use of the uterus. They're almost all, to one level or another, anti-gay.
That's a very simplistic view. I mean, that's not the case. I mean, that's just not the case.
Then who's the major anti-choice Republican running for president?
Well, look, abortion is a very tough issue to get into because, I mean, it's just not politics. It's a much deeper issue than saying there are a lot of people who happen to be pro-choice who don't believe that abortion is wrong. A lot of other people believe it is there. And so our party is the party of life. They believe that life, you know, is whether it's at birth or conception or somewhere in between, that's where life starts. And so, you know, it's not controlling somebody's uterus. I don't care what you do with your uterus, but once you decide to have a life,
but the legislation
matters.
Does.
Okay.
And let me just say this. If you are pro-gay and believe that women should be able to do what they want with the universes, come on, come to the Democratic Party. It's a big tent. It's fabulous. Come on in. We'll take
you. Well, we should point out, though, that right now, the best bet to get, finally, to get LGBT rights written into the state civil rights law is having it sponsored by a 20-something Republican serving in the state House.
Rick is talking about Frank Foster, and there was some talk that maybe Frank would be the one to introduce sexual identity as part of Elliot Larson.
Bless him. That's great.
And yet, this we talked about this, Rick and I did, more almost a year ago, and nothing's happened.
Wait till after the primary.
Big business has spoken. It'll happen.
So let's, unless there's any questions about LGBT, Elliot Larson, issues like that, we will move in the, let's do a quiz question.
Okay, Steve, are you ready?
Don't forget those other beers, too.
Yep. That's right, because we're working for beer.
Okay, so this is a true or false? Oh, no, you're right. We're having a little, it's just politics.
Okay, who was the first Michigan legislator, and for a bonus, where was he from? First Michigan legislator and where he was from to actually propose a bill to add sexual orientation protections to Michigan's civil rights law. Raise your hand.
I answer that question as Zuby's Jim Dressel.
No fair.
Well, I believe you now have a pair of 12-ounce pint glasses, yep. Don't you?
It was Republican Jim Dressel of Holland who lost his primary the following year.
So we've got, we're about two-thirds of the way into the evening. We've got a third left, which I think means we should spend the rest of it on what I think Rick and I are super, so incredibly excited about, which is election 2014. We could spend the rest of the week, the rest of the month, just talking about all of the politics that are going on.
And we will.
And we will. the insane amount of members, congressional members, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. It's amazing how many congressmen we are losing from Michigan incumbents and how many new faces we will see come November 2014. Let's start, though. I think we can't not start with what's going on with John Conyers. Joe DeSano, let me turn to you as a Democratic strategist. Talk us through, first of all, what's going on and the fact that he may not be on the ballot.
Well, I think it's more than likely he's not on the ballot. Basically, in one sentence, he didn't get enough signatures. He trusted the wrong people, bad staff work.
How does that happen?
Yeah.
Ask Thad McConnell.
Well, let me quickly tell you how it doesn't happen. In 1996, my job was to gather enough petitions for John Dingell to return to Congress. As a 23-year-old kid, that was my job. It was my responsibility. But the immense oversight I had from the congressman himself really served as an example of the fact that details matter in politics. And John Conyers, you know, for years we've had rumors about his attentiveness. He may have finally caught up to him, and I do not think he will be on the ballot. He's hired a stellar election attorney, John Peerich, but it's not going to be enough, I think.
Without Conyers, we are also losing Senator Carl Levin. We are losing Congressman Mike Rogers, John Dingell. Rick and I did some math. We're looking at over 133 years of experience. A lot of people are talking about the loss of influence. But what does that actually mean, Saul, when we say the loss of influence?
Well, I think it's huge. I mean, look, Michigan had one of the most powerful delegations in the country in a bipartisan standpoint. When they had to sit down and get things done for Michigan, Republicans and Democrats oftentimes got together and work together to do, like, Michigan-specific things. And to lose the influence that we have, whether it is a Carl Levin or a Dave Camp, Mike Rogers, and others, it is going to have a huge effect politically for us. And unfortunately, in our system, seniority matters. And so, you know, basically, look, you're one step away. If Fred Upton decided not to run, the dean of the delegation would be Candace Miller, who not so long ago was our Secretary of State. I mean, you're talking about a very young, not too influential class, potentially, that would be representing Michigan. I think it's going to be tough for us.
It is, but here's the deal. First of all, it seems unlikely that Democrats are going to take control of the House. And certainly the big question is whether or not they can hang on to the Senate in D.C. Michigan's mission and of its House Republican delegation is to send a freshman to the Appropriations Committee, which we have not had a member from Michigan, I think, since Carolyn Kilpatrick and Joe Nolenberg. And so the mission of the Michigan delegation is going to be to send a Michigan lawmaker to the House Appropriations Committee.
Well, look, with the lack of earmarks, that becomes less and less of an important mission. I mean, I think there's more important representation that'll be out there with respect to regulatory issues that affect our auto industry.
That's what Fred Upton is for.
Et cetera. Well, yeah, there's a lot of folks, and we can't, you know, I think if you take a look at jobs, you get back to how we get Michigan back on track is we need to have, you know, a regulatory climate that allows us to create jobs and bring, you know, new companies back here and be competitive.
But again,
another thing too is both of the delegations are that is the Democratic and the Republican delegations that Michigan sends to Congress is. Right now, I mean, they meet both individually and collectively, and they talk about what they're doing on their committee work, how they can help each other out with their projects. The loss, really, probably the most significant losses are Dingell because of his longevity and just, you know, his stature and how many people he knows. But after that, Dave Camp, because of how many people he affects as the Ways and Means Chair, and Mike Rogers, not because he's chair of the Intelligence Committee, but because he is one of the Midwest regional representatives to the steering committee that decides which members get appointed to which committees and which bills are going on the floor. And we'll see if another Michigander will go there, because there's not one in line right now.
So I think we're still talking about this big picture idea, and we keep using the word influence. What I would love is a list of two, three, maybe even four things that, let's say, in 6 months after November, a year after November, any of us in this room may begin to actually see why that influence was important to our daily lives.
Carl Levin, you could lose millions and millions of dollars of military spending, particularly in Macomb County.
Selfridge Air Force Base.
But also there's a lot of military suppliers along Grosbeck. You've got a situation where Battle Creek, the whole military facility there could just disappear.
That northern Michigan, like Calcasta to Alpena, yeah. Homeland Defense Strip.
There are real-life implications for people in those communities as a direct result of Carl Levin's longevity and chairmanship of that committee.
And if you take a look at Day Camp on the other side, over 60% of all the lobbyists in Washington are lobbying the Ways and Means Committee, and there's a reason for it. And I would argue that if you did the math, it's probably close to 60% of the lobbyists that are sent from Michigan to lobby Washington are there on the Ways and Means Committee. And so when you're looking at, you know, tax policy that affects the big three, when you're looking at tax policy that affects, you know, our furniture manufacturers and the imports, et cetera, that has a big difference and an influence. And then you take a look at even a Fred Upton, who chairs Commerce Committee, much of his influence came from the ability to use a Carl Levin, a Dave Camp, or anybody
and
else.
And his ranking Democrat, that. John Dingell.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Look, I think that we underestimate our congressional delegation is still a group of people that used to work together in the old ways. And even though they were very partisan, they fought each other on partisan issues, they all came together when it came to Michigan. And even if you agreed to disagree, you know, oftentimes, I mean, back when I was state chairman, I was in meetings, you know, where, you know, Jennifer Graham would call me Mr. A Nuisance, and we couldn't even talk in Michigan, and we'd be sitting in the same offices in Washington trying to get things done and figure out how we could get things done for the state of Michigan. And that included Republicans and Democrats from both sides. So, you know, this is going to be a big loss for us. I don't know. Much of it will depend on who replaces these folks. I mean, you know, on either side, we could get, you know, crazy folks that just are not going to be very strong representatives, and that hurts us. That's going to hurt the state long term. And
I heard there was this guy, Saul Anousis, who was thinking about running in the
8th. He's a loser.
Actually.
He obviously can't run. That, what you really need is somebody who's qualified, who, you know, is much more, you know, sane, and I hope we'll elect a couple of those.
You know, one of the interesting things is the delegations would get together and Republicans would do favors for Democrats when there was a Republican in the White House. Democrats would do favors for Republicans when there was a Democrat in the White House because they knew that the tables would turn and it was in their interest to look out for each other. And that's why you want to have seniority on both sides of the aisle.
But now
you're just talking about the influence game.
We're dealing with a hyper-partisan world based on gerrymandered districts.
And this is actually, that is a wonderful bridge to where I would like to go to next, which is before we head to November, look to August 6th. Some serious primaries, many congressional districts here in Michigan. Whoever wins that primary will most likely, for all intents and purposes, go on to win November. I'm talking about a Debbie Dingell. I'm talking about some other districts, though, where we're going to see some pretty heavy primaries. And actually, Saul, I want to get your idea on this, because some intra-party fights between establishment Republicans and some Tea Party members. I'm thinking about Brian Ellis and Justin Amash in the 3rd District, Carrie Benevolio and David Trott in the 11th. How big of an issue is that going to be for Republicans?
Well, it is a big issue. I mean, again, there's a lot of frustrated people out there. You know, on the Republican side, they're expressing their views by joining the Tea Party and getting involved. And there is a, you know, there's a prevalent kind of philosophy of throw the bums out, regardless of who they are. And that makes it very difficult. And I think if you take a look at, you know, like Mike Rogers' seat, or take a look at David Camp's seat, I mean, there are going to be some very competitive races. Interestingly enough, I would argue if you sat these people down and talked to them philosophically about 90% of the issues that would matter on either side of the aisle, they would be within 90% of each other. It's more a function of style versus substance. You know, we are now in a position where people love to throw bombs. People love to shake things up. People want to have, you know, they want to have a revolution. You know, I wrote in my newsletter this week in the difference between Burke and some of the others with respect to Jefferson, who wanted revolution, and Burke, who wanted, you know, some kind of a civil society with respect to being coming from a conservative perspective. I got tons of emails of people talking about me selling out and saying, you know, what's wrong with the revolution, you know? I mean, this is where we're at. People, you know, that I think that's a degree of their frustration. And we're going to have to go through that. Look, we have had major party fights for a long, long time. I was involved in 1987-88 when we did the Bush-Kemp-Robertson battles. We hated each other. I mean, people would come in and we'd have fights inside of delegations. We had people who had armed guards at their homes because, you know, there were death threats and bomb threats. And, I mean, this was a fight for the heart and soul of the party. 6 or 8 years later, we were stronger and better for it, but it took a long time to get past that. And I think we're in a very similar situation today where we're going to kick the crap out of each other for at least a cycle or two to come, and hopefully it won't be too late where Republicans won't suffer too big of a loss.
Well, I'm going to put my prognosticator cap on and say that most of the Tea Party folks will fade away in this next set of primaries. I think the cards are stacked against them. Their candidates, from my perspective, are inferior to the establishment candidates. So I think Saul's right. The fights are going to continue. I think the establishment eventually will crush them under their heels.
But how? Why and how? I mean, that's a broad
statement. Why and
how? Yeah, I mean, you're saying one
money
cycle,
and quality
what
of candidates.
Three things. One, the 1987 fight that you were talking about, there is a T-shirt out there that says, I survived the 1987 Republican presidential delegate selection process.
Rick is desperately looking for this T-shirt. If anyone knows anyone who has it, I will pay good money for
it. I will pay for it.
Yeah.
And I will pay for it myself. I may actually have one,
but I'll have to look. My wife didn't throw
That's
it
away. That's thing one. Thing two is the Tea Party has always been a part of the Republican Party in Michigan and nationally. It's just been a question of how engaged it is. That tension may fade. It will not go away. In Michigan, this is point three, one of the interesting things, though, is that we are seeing some Tea Party challenges in legislative races, but the big congressional primaries in Michigan are not Tea Party challenges to incumbents. Fred Upton has one, but it's not that serious. It's actually business people saying to essentially Tea Partiers, we want our party back. That there is a lot of frustration that Benvolio has tried to play ball once he got there, but just hasn't proved to be particularly adept at it. And until very recently, Justin Amash has been essentially boycotting Republican delegation meetings, and just a lot of people are sick of it. So you've got people saying, we don't want ideological candidates. We don't want people who are passionate about ideas at the expense of deal-making.
They want people who can get things done. This is where Rick Snyder, as an example, is a very different governor and a very different Republican. I mean, if you talk to Rick Snyder on political issues, he doesn't want to engage in them. I mean, this guy wants to get things done. You may not agree with him on 100% of the things he's doing, but he's sitting there looking at it from his perspective as a Republican to get things done. On the other hand, you have somebody like Justin Amash, who very fervently believes in what he believes in and would rather stand on principles and lose then lose his principles and win.
Oh, I don't know about that. He didn't run for the U.S. Senate this year. That would have been a great test of his principles.
No, that would have been a great test of his electability. He's not stupid. I mean, that's not a fair...
You guys keep doing my job for me because that is another beautiful bridge. I would like to move over to the U.S. Senate seat between Terry Lynn Land and Gary Peters. And I think a question that I'm hearing a lot is where is Terry Lynn Land?
She's neck and neck in the polls, raising more money than Gary Peters, and is threatening to be the next United States Senator for Michigan.
So
I think she's being real smart about it.
And this is my follow-up question. We haven't heard a lot from her in the media or from her campaign, and yet she, in a lot of polls, is within the margin of error or beating Peters. What is behind this strategy? And who's
she reminds me of John Travolta in that old TV movie, The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. About 1976, I think. And that's a strategy that they've devised to keep her hermetically sealed. I mean, you're a member of the press. How many press conferences has she had, press availabilities, where they've had to clean up after?
She is
basically, the answer is all of them.
She is fundraising, securing her base, and making her mistakes on a very small stage before she has to enter onto a very large...
Another way to put it is she is on her way to be the next United States Senator from Michigan.
I would hardly think that's the case, but...
But so are we getting some agreement, though, that is good strategy?
Oh, it's a fine strategy, but the question is, how long can she sustain it?
Hopefully until November 4th or 5th.
She's a human gaffe machine. Just send her up north and forget that she exists and run the TV ads. That's the best strategy you got. And on the other side... We've got Gary Peters, who's doing yet another listening tour, engaging voters, talking to voters, raising money, engaging voters. He's out there hustling.
No, look, I mean, it's great. You got a Democrat, millionaire, Merrill Lynch, Wall Street guy running as a hypocrite for Democrats.
Earned every penny.
Yeah, he earned every penny. That's right.
I would say he earned his pennies far, far more than Terry Lynn Land did.
I think an argument could be made that there's actually three different candidates running in that race, though. Is it fair to say that there's Gary Peters, there's Terry Lynn Land, and then the shadow of Barack Obama and Obamacare?
Absolutely.
Joe DeSano.
Where has Obamacare moved the needle at all in this race?
Is Gary Peters...
When the AFP put up its, the Americans for Prosperity put up their ads against Gary Peters on Obamacare, that's when his numbers started to move in the wrong direction.
Well, and he also spent money himself to push the numbers back.
Right. No, so. I agree. I think Gary Peters ought to go out there and talk about Obamacare, why it's good for America.
You should have worked for
me. Why it costs more for, you know, the average person, why you can't keep your
doctor.
I'm
the average person.
Why every union in Michigan has been exempt from it. Every Democrat special interest has gotten exempt from it. It's a great program as long as you don't have to get into it.
Hey, I'm into it. It works perfect.
Hey, mister, that's policy. We're here to talk politics.
And the fact of the matter is, it is working.
I was on a plane with Jimmy Hoffa, and it was right after the letter came out, you know, Hoffa's letter to the president. And I said, so what, you know, what's going to happen? And he turned to me and he said, Obama forgot who put him there, you know, and they got their exemption. And, you know, that was a little bit of politics and they're out of it. Now, you know, as a former Teamster, you know, unfortunately, I don't qualify anymore because I'm self-employed, but.
Well, I'm self-employed too, and my health care plan is under Obamacare, and it works like a charm.
So I'm hearing agreement between you two that he absolutely should run on Obamacare.
Absolutely. Bring it out, baby.
I will take that challenge. Do not shirk from it. It is working and helping people all across the state.
I agree 100%. Bring it on.
So you say that Obamacare is a net positive for Gary
Peters? Oh, I'm not saying it's a net positive, but it sure as hell ain't anything you should run from.
Agreed, 100%.
Wait. But those
we
are two
need
things.
To be talking about Obamacare. We need to be talking about Obamacare.
I agree.
What do you mean that it is not necessarily a net positive, but he should not be running from it?
Because it's an issue of character as well. He voted for it. He should own up to the success of it.
Absolutely.
He absolutely shouldn't. I don't think he will shirk from it before this thing's done.
Are Democrats who are trying to run from Obamacare making a mistake?
Yes.
We're hearing a very interesting, I think some would say great political mind, Bill Clinton, saying the same thing, which is Democrats don't run away from it, run towards it. I think Saul and Joe are both agreeing with Bill Clinton on that.
I don't think Saul is agreeing for the same reasons, though.
I am agreeing with Bill Clinton for the same reasons. I want Hillary to run for president.
You're going to get your wish.
Let's talk quickly in the last 10 minutes that we have or so. Really, I want to get in the gubernatorial race. I also want to get in the fact that the entire state house, the entire state senate up for re-election, as well as AG, Secretary of State. So we'll try to do a little bit of a lightning round. Joe DeSano, has Mark Schauer done enough to get his image out there? Is he doing enough to get...
Mark Schauer, right.
There is a lot of work to be done. The Democratic Governors Association has came in. They've invested in this race because they know that the governor is vulnerable. There's no polling that shows the governor over 50%. Mark Schauer has done a lot in this race. Mm-hmm. Is it enough? Mark will be the first person to tell you at this point, no.
So as a political consultant, what does he have to do to gain traction between now and November?
Step aside
and let another Democrat run.
Too late.
Raise lots of money. Spend that money.
Yeah, go to Wall Street.
Slap the nerd around a little bit.
But he wasn't doing that well in fundraising.
He's doing well. I don't think that... I wouldn't characterize it like that.
Saul, I asked you this question a couple weeks ago, and I will ask you again. How's Governor Snyder doing when it comes to his reelection campaign?
I think he's doing very well. I mean, there's a couple reasons. One is we've talked about that... He is not a typical Republican. He's a moderate mainstream Republican who wants to get things done. And the only reason he's probably running as a Republican is you have to choose which party you run on. I mean, he is a very different political figure in that regard. And at the same time, Mark Schauer is probably one of the weakest candidates the Democrats have ever nominated for governor. They look for alternatives.
And yet he's only 3 or 4 points behind your guy.
Right, because we live in a state that basically is a Democratic state. So, I mean, it's not rocket science.
Yeah.
You know, I think
it's not a Democratic state in midterm elections, though.
Well, it's look, it's a purple state that can go red under the right circumstances, right?
So what are, in your professional opinions, and I'm asking Joe to, you know, to put on your old two guys named Joe hat. Mm. What, in your professional opinions, are the structural dynamics at play in this election? What do the people who are planning campaigns need to be
Democrats is just one simple sentence. Recreate as much of the Obama coalition as possible. You're not going to get 100%. If you get 40 to 50%, you probably could win this thing.
Saul?
You know, look, I think that we have to obviously get our voters out to the polls. We have to identify voters who agree with us. I think we have to identify every Obamacare supporter in the state. And I think that the more we talk about Obamacare, the better off we'll be. So I think structurally,
please,
you know, we have our base.
I beg you, put all the eggs in that basket.
Let's you know, I mean, let's roll the dice, brother. I'm with you. So lucky nine, black, or however you want to play it.
So there are three primaries happening in other states today. One of them, Ohio, a state that's not unlike Michigan. What sort of signals are you guys going to be looking for in those races in those elections that we're going to see tonight?
I would look for, not just tonight, but every primary night across the country, for the business establishment to crush the Tea Party. That's what I would look for.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's that simple, but I would say probably the most important and interesting race in the country tonight is North Carolina. You have, on the Republican side, you have a classic battle going on between a libertarian Ron Paul-backed candidate, a Christian right Mike Huckabee-backed candidate, and kind of more of a mainstream business establishment Mitt Romney-backed candidate. All three of them are in play. All three of them are in a very competitive situation. All three of them are well-funded. And it truly is a extension and a very interesting analysis to see, you know, what kind of fight we'll have for the heart and soul. Who will actually turn out? Who actually cares enough to go to the polls? And it is a question. Look, if you take a look at, you know, regardless of what you think of Republicans, I would argue that like a lot of my friends sit on the sideline because they don't want to get in the middle of a fight. They don't necessarily want to come out. And that makes it very difficult because those who are willing to go battle would rather come out and spend 6 hours talking about the gold standard,
right?
Where I'd rather go watch my kid play lacrosse.
As a general rule, the angrier voter is the one who shows up.
In the midterms, yeah.
Yeah.
In all elections, actually. But, I mean, in this case, you got a lot of people who just are not going to be fired up. There's a lot of disenchanted voters. And, you know, look, part of our problem is our base. I mean, this is what we're battling about. We're trying to figure out, can we bring it out? Can we make it loyal? And when you're looking for purity, it makes it very difficult to pull together a center-right coalition.
I mean, is it fair to say that right now when you're looking at coalition building that the Republican Party is going through a more transformational period than the Democratic Party?
Yes. They're going through a similar situation that Democrats dealt with in the late 80s and early 90s. Right now, in my opinion, in 20 years, someone's going to write a book and talk about how the modern Republican Party was lost based on gay issues and immigration. If for the way this country is going demographically, right now, Republicans have voter repellent.
Saul, you're shaking your head, but I think immigration has to be something.
Hold one second. Saul actually is on the right side of this stuff, so I don't point my finger at him.
Well, I think that's an oversimplification of where we're at. We have problems.
I spend my life oversimplicating.
Of course, that's part of the game. But I think if you take a look at, you know, immigration reform, I think there are ways to legalize. There's a process called the red card, and if any of you have not seen it, you ought to take a look at it. And I've been pushing it amongst Republicans that would basically legalize illegal immigrants without basically giving them immediate citizenship or giving them citizenship. And part of the problem is, you know, my family immigrated to this country. I didn't learn to speak English until I was 7 years old. You know,
you're doing well.
You know,
and then you haven't stopped.
And then I'm still trying to figure it out.
You know? I have to give the governor credit. This is one issue I absolutely adore him on.
Immigration?
Immigration. Is.
But a lot of Republicans don't.
Like Saul. My father came here in 1966 from Italy. I'm a son of an immigrant, so this is a very personal issue for me. And the governor's got it right, and I kick his butt regularly in public. I'm going to say this one. He's absolutely correct.
So we've got a few minutes left, and I would love to prioritize. And that would be that we, as I mentioned earlier, we have a gubernatorial race. We have a race for Secretary of State, for Attorney General, all of our congressional districts, the entire state house, the entire state Senate. Joe, when you look at that, help me prioritize from a strategy viewpoint. What seats are most important to Democrats in Michigan right now? Is it the state house? Is it the gubernatorial? Is it the open Senate?
It's the governor's office. It's the House of Representatives. And then everything else is a distant third.
Okay. Saul?
Look, I would argue the best shot the Democrats have is holding on to the U.S. Senate seat. I think that Rick Snyder will win re-election with comfortable numbers. I think the House will potentially lose a couple seats, but I think they'll hold on to their majority. The Senate will hold on to their majority, and I don't think we lose a congressional delegation. So I think that we have probably a whole lot of status quo, and the biggest battle will be on the Senate side and by default gubernatorial, just because the state's a swing state.
And where will the most money be spent out of all of those?
U.S. Senate.
Yeah, U.S. Senate, no question.
U.S. Senate is the national, both the national party's top priority. After that, they will look and try and figure – Democrats will look and try and figure out whether or not they have a bigger shot at the
you
state
know what?
House.
Here's the thing. Everyone's down on Gary Peters. He's going to put this thing away by the end of summer.
So what I'm hearing then is maybe are we all agreeing that come November 5th, things are going to seem pretty similar to what they look like right now?
Yeah. I think that's a fair statement. For all the Sturm und Drang, it's going to end up being just the way
it is. Which is very similar to what we saw in Michigan come 2012 after all of those
ballot
initiatives.
Right, so save your money, and most of the folks in this room ought to just stay home.
And spend it on beer instead. Does anyone have any questions for Joe or
Saul? For Joe, for Saul?
Sorry, you know, I'm trying to see how much time we have. We've got about 5 minutes left. We will do one last quiz question, but if you have questions, now is the time. We'll open it up.
Okay. What?
You know
That's
what?
That's not a question.
I'll tell you, though. Saul and I agree.
What is?
Get rid of it. Saul and I agree.
I don't agree in getting rid of the Electoral College, but I clearly think there has
actually,
to be
Actually, Saul is you're active in a reform.
Yeah, no, look, there are three basic reforms out there being talked about. One is moving to a congressional district plan. One is moving to a proportional plan, and one is moving to a national popular vote plan. I personally favor the national popular vote plan. I think that every vote in America ought to count and ought to count the same. I'm sick and tired of the idea that Ohio and Florida voters are more important than Michigan voters. I think that the next most plausible plan is a proportional plan because it makes sure that every voice is heard. And I think the congressional district plan is an exacerbation of the current problem in this plan. I mean, today we elect the president of the swing states of America instead of the president of the United States of America. And I think that's a big problem.
Oh, we have another question right here. Yeah, sorry.
Okay, quick.
Oh, okay.
Quick.
The podcast, man. You got as long as the beer's going, we can go.
Whatever happened to the bridge to Canada?
Speaking of the mic.
Yeah, whatever happened to the Bridge to Canada thing?
The Bridge to Canada is underway right now. There is a fight in Congress underway, and actually John Conyers is sort of critical to this, over whether or not they're going to fund the Customs Plaza, which is a critical part of an international border crossing. That's a place where Michigan's congressional clout is going to be really, really important.
Mine has to do with the budget surplus that we currently have. Mm-hmm. Is that something that's going to be, if as long as Democrats get out and vote and we replace Governor Snyder, is that something that he's going to be able to push through real quick and give to his friends, or is that something that once the Democrats take back over, we can refund public education again?
First of all, you know, we'll see where the budget surplus is at May 15th when we do our next official revenue estimates.
Estimating.
But every dollar has to be appropriated by the legislature. So whatever gets done, it's going to have to, you know, it's going to have to, you know, be the governor, the House, the Senate. They're all Republicans, but they've all got to do it, and they're not always on the same page.
Keep an eye out, though, for the next 2 weeks' budget bills. Jake Neer just let us know that right now the House was voting, Senate was voting, 150 amendments on one omnibus bill. We're not quite sure where that is right now, but you will see a lot of news about the budget come
it's moving
June
right
1st.
Now. Oh, and yeah. Kathy Gray of the Detroit Free Press says it passed.
Oh, thank you, Kathy
Thanks,
Gray.
Kat. And we're glad that they got done in time for you to be here.
Yeah.
Karen.
So the Center for Michigan has been doing all these community conversations, and they came out with their four top priorities, and one of them was reducing poverty. And so I'm interested in how are the Republicans going to reduce poverty, and how is that going to help our state? And given that that was one of the top four things that people across the state of Michigan say is a real concern. So
That study didn't say how to reduce poverty, and maybe even the more salient thing about that is we've got almost a deadlock on where the pub if these numbers are to be believed from the Center for Michigan on where the public stands and what we do about revenue. One third says that we should increase taxes. One third says we should cut taxes. One third says that we should keep taxes exactly where they are. That doesn't provide politicians with a lot of direction as to how they go about that.
I get that, except that it was still among the top four things that people across the state of Michigan said in all these community conversations was we need to reduce poverty. So I know what the Dems are thinking. So what are we going
to
do about
that?
Yeah,
I think the best thing we do to reduce poverty is create an environment where we can actually bring jobs back to Michigan. So I think that right to work is going to be a big factor that will help us as things calm down. Look, all the scare tactics of we're going to take away unions and break up all these unions and do all, none of them happen.
And the jobs didn't show up either.
Well, the jobs didn't show up because they're waiting for a recall of the where they're waiting for an initiative to make something happen. So I think as the system calms down and people are comfortable, the fact that Michigan is going to stay as an effective right-to-work state, I think you're going to see jobs coming. There'll be a choice. And I think that, again, we have a lot of other regulatory
Except
things.
Except that right-to-work as a political controversy has fizzled. And
yeah,
that,
that's, and, I think that's and, a good and thing. That, I think that's a good thing for
which
Michigan.
Means that
it may have around fizzled initiative as is not a going to. Issue. But the fact of the matter is the jobs didn't show up either.
Well, I mean, our unemployment has gone down relative to
other
states.
If it's such a great business environment, they should be rushing to get in here.
They should. That's why we should raise the minimum wage to $25 an hour.
We've got a couple more questions. Yeah, hi.
Barb O'Kelly.
Hi, Barb.
To be very specific, do you have, all four of you, have prognosis on the 8th district race? And what are going to be the factors in who replaces Mike Rogers?
The factors are going to be who wins the Republican primary.
What is it?
It's like 54% Republican district.
If this were a Democratic wave year, the Democrats could take it. It looks like it's going to be a fight between Mike Bishop, who's been endorsed by Mike Rogers, and Tom McMillan, who's kind of a Tea Partier, who's been endorsed by Justin Amash. And for them, it's going to be who does a better job of getting out their voters. I think the smart money is probably behind Mike Bishop.
Agreed.
Hi there, Scott Smith, independent. So in the 21st century, in the age of the internet, why can't we get rid of representative democracy and go with direct democracy instead?
Well, I think it's a bad idea, but
yeah, I wouldn't.
Why? Because there are too many uneducated, ill-informed voters out there.
They're all on his side.
And senators and congressmen, I would agree. I mean, look, I think that,
Look at the educational background of some of our legislators.
Right. Let alone some of
Terrifying.
Our voters.
Though our system is set up to be a representative democracy where our representatives actually bring their judgment to the table and not one where everybody votes on everything. I think you'd literally have to change the Constitution.
Well, you could. But, I mean, the issue is we do have a representative democracy. We have smart people and dumb people. Republicans and Democrats are relevant. You've got hard workers and people don't work that hard, and we do represent the general public.
No, there's a Democratic House Speaker named Lou Dodak who said just that everybody gets representative from everyone gets represented from millionaires to felons.
Right.
And some more
breathers
than others.
Kyle.
I have a question for everyone on the panel.
Speaking of the mic, Kyle.
Oh, sorry. Well, my name
it's
is
not
Gary.
Kyle.
Yep. Yes, I have a question. I did my master's degree on the city of Detroit and their financial crisis. I was wondering why hasn't the city turned to a city-private partnership in order to do most of the projects in those communities?
Politics and labor.
That's one of them, and like a lot, it's they're still looking at that a lot of communities, public-private partnerships are kind of where things are going right now. It's how we built the international bridge in Detroit. It's gonna be part of what's going on in the city.
Well, they've already started with trash hauling.
Yeah, exactly. And they're already apologizing for it.
And the city of Flint and Kettering are doing a lot of public-private partnerships at a smaller scale than the city of Detroit. But we are seeing some really urban cities that are trying that and seeing how it's working. And actually, in the first couple of years, some of it really is working, and it's getting residents to be take more ownership over their city.
No, I think public-private partnerships is part of the wave of the 21st century.
Okay, I'm getting to wrap it up, so we'll do one last question, and then we'll do a quiz question, and I think that'll be it.
My name is Jordan Ballard. I'm a Democrat. I'm wondering, in the 2012 election, we voted to get rid of the emergency manager law, and then it was promptly brought back, put into place, and Detroit went under emergency management. What do you think it would be like if Detroit came out of emergency management and then went back in again, as other cities have done in Michigan? What is a better option? Because it doesn't seem to work.
Well, they came out of emergency out of receivership and back into receivership under the old emergency manager law, and by that I mean two emergency manager laws ago. Okay. And so one of the rationales for the current emergency manager law, whether you like it or not, is that it's a much stronger, stricter emergency manager law. After it was repealed by voters, the governor and the legislature went back. Republicans, Democrats were opposed to it, and said that they basically fixed up sort of the exit strategy, and that's what is going to keep what you're talking about happen. But brother, that is, you know, that's going to be the acid test.
And let's remember too, this is the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history. This is a laboratory right now. So anyone who has any idea of what's going to happen, what will happen, what Detroit's going to look like in 5 or 10 years is full of it, because but none of us know. There's ideas of what to do, but no one can tell you what it's going to be like. And this is what everyone's trying to figure out right now together. That's what makes the storyline so interesting to watch.
But this is Rick Snyder's legacy, that if Detroit goes back into a financial crisis at some point in the foreseeable future, then he is a failure. If it does not, then he succeeded.
On that note,
one more question.
One more final question for the final pint glass. Are we ready, Steve Krupinski? Okay. Question, this is true or false? There has never been a governor from the Upper Peninsula.
1% of the population of Michigan.
1% of the population lives in the UP. Has there ever been a governor from the Upper Peninsula?
False.
What's the answer?
Anthony, you want to take a shot at it?
No.
He said false. No.
He's right.
Anthony, go for it, dude.
Got an answer?
False.
Yeah, right. So I stated it two different ways, so I think we have two pie glasses left, though. Anthony, you only get to put soda in it, okay? Okay, or juice.
Until you're 21.
Right.
I don't know about that.
So I stated it two different ways. It's totally my fault. The first time I said true or false, and I said there's never been. Anyway, here we go. Chase Osborne, governor from 1911 to 1913. But we have a bonus Chase Osborne question. My favorite. Don't roll your eyes. This is a good one. Okay.
You know, and you don't get a glass.
Chase Osborne is buried on Sugar Island. What international organization was offered the island as a location for its headquarters?
I know the answer.
Well, you don't get to do it.
I'll be quiet.
We might have to.
Oh, come on, take a guess.
It's an evil, evil international organization. Think Agenda 21 if you're a Glenn Beck fan.
She's saying the United Nations.
United Nations. The city of Sault Ste. Marie offered it up, but I guess just New York has better politicians.
Yes.
They didn't have a place to park up there. Well, thanks for not throwing eggs, and I appreciate the free beer.
Anytime, Saul. Thank you, everyone, for coming out. Thank you to NBC for being
to Mark.
Lovely hosts. Saul would love another Hefeweizen. And Rick and I will probably be here for a couple of minutes if anyone has any other question.
Thank you to Mark. By the way, the mac and cheese is awesome. So is the pork.
Yeah. And thanks to Bob Scon and Steve Krupinski and Alyssa Daniels for taking care of everyone.
Our exceptional tweeter.